Welcome to this Trending Globally Explainer. I'm sitting with Professor Jim Green, who knows more about Brazil than practically anyone else we could find. And we're going to talk about the Brazilian elections. So Jim, the results in, tell us about it.
Well, Jair Bolsonaro, the far-right candidate, polled 55% of the votes, 57 million. And Fernando Haddad, representing the left, the Workers' Party and other supporters, got 45% of the votes, about 47 million. Bolsonaro is the new president of Brazil.
So why did the Workers' Party not do as well as they've done in the past, particularly because Bolsonaro has been quite explicit on basically what he wants to do to leftists personally and what he wants to do to their public policy? You would think that the people that have benefited from Bolsa Família and other programs would be motivated to get out more.
So I think many people who did benefit were motivated to get out, and they did vote, and they voted clearly in favor of Haddad. He did very well in the Northeast, which has historically been the most impoverished and most disadvantaged part of the country, and he did extremely well there. I think there are a lot of factors which led people to decide that Bolsonaro was their savior, including a strong discourse, a campaign against corruption in which the Workers' Party and other parties were involved, some people in those parties, a fear that has been engendered within the population about violence and crime and his simplistic solutions to them, and a discrediting of the traditional politicians, although actually, if one would make that argument that they threw all the bums out, they actually didn't throw out the Workers' Party, because the Workers' Party, although lost seats in the Senate and a few seats in the Congress, in the lower house, if you sum their votes with those of the party to the left of them, the Party of Socialism and Liberty, they actually have about the same number of people in the Congress. Bolsonaro's party, which went from 1 to 47 or 46 Congress people, is only represents only 10% of the Congress, so he has a lot of work ahead to sew together a working majority to get his legislation passed.
So let's start there. So there's a presidential system. Someone from a minor party who's very much a populist figure has now won the presidency, but he doesn't command a kind of congressional or parliamentary majority. There's no natural party for him with enough seats to get things through. Is that right?
Right. And so there are two ways in which coalitions are built. One is wheeling and dealing within the Congress so that they can choose a speaker of the House that will represent in the lower and the upper house a working majority, theoretically, and also the way that the president will hand out ministries to allies and other people in other political parties, and politicians are interested in heading ministries because there's a lot of plum jobs and appointments, political appointments for their advisees, the people that have worked with them. So there are, I'm not remembering this very moment, but there are tens of thousands of political appointments within the administration that the president can effect by choosing certain ministers who then will choose the people in the lower level of the higher echelon of the bureaucracies.
Isn't this the very definition of the corruption that he was railing against?
He would have argued that people took those positions and used them to get paybacks and put money into their pockets. In fact, the people that he will most likely be building his coalition with are the very people that have been under investigation for corruption in the centrist parties, the political parties in the center. So we're probably going to see several ministers, if not more than a few ministers, who are actually under investigations for corruption. However, people in Congress have investigative immunity, so while they're in Congress, they can't be condemned for crimes they've committed. So there's actually a reason why some people want to run for office, because that kind of gives them immunity from prosecution.
So there's a tremendous irony here, then, that basically the car wash shakes loose corruption in these mainstream parties. The left party will, I presume, stand on principle and say, we're not taking part in this coalition. And that creates a set of incentives for people who are deeply corrupt and publicly known to be so, to cooperate so they can get a job to protect them from prosecution.
In addition to that, to carry out the policies and the programs that they defend, which will include several things, really implementing a very open door policy to foreign investment, encouraging foreign capital investment. It will include privatization of many state owned industries and government entities. It will include opening the Amazon to agribusiness and deforestation. I would assume he will withdraw from the Paris Agreement. I will assume he will try to build close bilateral relations with Trump, although there will be problems with tariffs and issues about tariffs and trade there. He will carry out his promises to encourage the sale of firearms to anyone in the population with no controls at all. He will try to pass a provision in which police who are involved in any shootings are have impunity from any investigation about the cause of their shooting so that they cannot be investigated. And since there's already been a strong tradition in Brazil of many innocent people presumed guilty for being black and therefore shot by the police before they can really determine what is really happening, this will just encourage the police to feel that they can shoot at will anyone who looks allegedly suspicious. It's a very serious moment for Brazil.
It certainly sounds like it. I mean, we worry here about, you know, the overreach of authority and police targeting certain groups in society, but this just seems to be a whole different scale.
It's going to be much, much worse. And in addition to that, he's promised to bring many military leaders into the government as head of ministries. So there will be a cabinet which will have many generals in them, which is something that people really fought against in the process of democratization after the military ruled from 1964 to 1985.
So let's try and puzzle this through. Apart from sort of, you know, the left not doing well enough accepting this one core stronghold, other reasons behind this. You said earlier that the population has been inculcated with this fear of crime, but is the fear of crime real? Has it been increasing? Is it something that is a general concern?
So there is an increase in violence and crime. It's largely connected to two factors, the drug trade, the cocaine trade, and the dispute between different gangs to have control of poor communities, which are the places in which drugs are stored and sold and transported out of the country or through the country. There's also been high unemployment in the last 2 years with a deep recession, which has caused a lot of unemployment has led a lot of people to resort to crime as a way to survive. So yes, this is a social problem, and I think that the Workers' Party wasn't as effective as it could have been about offering solutions. It really understands this is a global problem that it cannot be solved just by setting the army into the poor communities or giving impunity to officers who shoot to kill. But they didn't offer something that was tangible and immediate that people could hang on to, I believe. So middle class and other people who have been victims of crime, I think, saw these simple solutions as the way that the country could improve.
So it's a bit of a natural experiment about to happen. So advocates for continued freedom over, let's say, possession of firearms in the United States must be watching this one closely, because you have a baseline amount of crime. They're about to put a huge number of guns into circulation. We'll see if the crime rate goes down, which is what many of those people would hypothesize.
Right. And also we have to understand that there's a huge arms industry in Brazil and an international arms industry, which is very interested in seeing the increase in the sale of arms because it's a $1 billion industry.
Wow. Who even knew? One last thing. I was reading something today about Costa Rica. So Costa Rica is everyone's favorite little social democracy on the isthmus. But it turns out in 2017, they had a very, very contested and polarizing set of elections. And the piece that I read highlighted the role of evangelicals, essentially creating faith-based mini-parties that blew up the party system, stalled a needed budget reform, and nearly sent them into bankruptcy. We know that there's an evangelical component to the vote here, but I haven't really heard it spoken about. Last time we spoke very usefully about the kind of the status anxiety of middle-class and upper-middle-class white Brazilians about maids, etc. Can you say something about how evangelicals have changed Brazilian politics?
So until 30 years ago, Brazil was the largest Catholic country in the world. I think it still is, but the number of evangelicals has grown to 24 to 25% of the population. When we say evangelicals, it's a mixed bag. It's both what we today in the United States would call the mainline Christians, Protestants, Baptists, Methodists, Episcopalians, Congregationalists, but also the Pentecostal movement, which is very much community-based, it's neighborhood-based, it's based with people who basically can rent a hall and open up a church. And there are literally hundreds of thousands of these small churches. Many of them offer real spiritual responses to people's needs and are social networks and support networks and are very important in poor neighborhoods as a means of building community and support. Many of them are clearly money-making businesses where people take advantage of people's desire for religiosity and spirituality to get the 10% tithe and build business. And the most egregious example of this is the Universal Church of the Kingdom of God, which is a multi-billion dollar international enterprise founded in Brazil with mega churches. They've even constructed an alleged authentic copy of the Solomon's Temple in São Paulo. And they have taken over the second largest television broadcasting company. They endorsed Bolsonaro and throw their weight very heavily behind him, in addition to many other evangelical Christians. And so these are people who are very susceptible to issues of LGBTQ rights. And to answer their previous question more fully about why Bolsonaro won, in part this was due to a very effective WhatsApp campaign. WhatsApp is an application that people use to communicate by telephone. Cheaply or inexpensively or free, and they were able to send millions and millions and millions of these fake news about their opponent to create tremendous anxiety, especially among religious people, who then voted en masse for Bolsonaro.
So the dynamics of populism, violence, polarization, and fake news are not unique to the United States?
Not at all. In fact, Bolsonaro made a point of attacking the most important newspaper, the Folha de São Paulo, because they had reported on the fact that it seems that a large number of industrialists illegally gave millions of dollars to these companies to pay for the generation of the fake news. And this is something that will need to be investigated. But he then lashed out against the press and in the same tone of Donald Trump. And it's no accident that Donald Trump immediately called him and congratulated him. They'll try to build a strong alliance.
Who'd have thought we'd end up in this space?
I certainly didn't.
Did not see this coming.
Well, I saw it coming in the last 3 years in the sense that clearly the attempts to and the effective ability to impeach President Dilma Rousseff for fake reasons and trumped up reasons that are really not justifiable, and the rise of the conservative right, the discrediting of politicians as a whole, and the international wave of right-wing governments in power, I think kind of made this somewhat predictable.
So in a sense, we have seen this one coming. It's just that we're attuned to the signals coming from places like Western Europe, but we are really dealing with a truly global phenomenon.
It's a global phenomenon.
We live in interesting times.
We do. And let's hope that we can see a quick return to democracy in Brazil, real democracy, not the kind of democracy that it was going to be chipped away at by Bolsonaro and even the threat of a military intervention.
Let's hope. Thanks for the chat, Jim.
Thank you.
This has been Trending Globally, Politics and Policy. If you enjoyed today's conversation, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher, or download us on your favorite podcasting app. If you like us, rate us, and help others who might enjoy the show find us. For more information, go to watson.brown.edu.